It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Kyle Macy is with us today. He is a member of the UK Athletics Hall of Fame, three-time All-American at Kentucky, who helped lead the Wildcats to the 1978 NCAA Basketball Championship. He was the SEC Player of the Year in 1980, went on to play in the NBA for seven seasons, and then played professionally in Italy for three more years. He played his high school basketball in Peru, Indiana, was named Mr. Basketball in Indiana in 1975. And later, he was the head coach at Morehead State for nine seasons, and that included a first-place finish in the Ohio Valley Conference in 2003. And he has had a long and successful career as a broadcaster, including with the UK Network and many regional and national broadcasts on radio and television. Kyle, great to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
It's tournament time now. We're recording on March 10th. Kentucky starts in the SEC tournament this year and, of course, the NCAA tournament to follow. How do you follow NCAA in March? Are you in front of the TV for hours at a time, or do you follow it in a little more casual way?
Probably more casual. In past years, I've been in some pools, so you follow a little bit more. But I never do very well in those because there's so many teams you really don't get to see during the season. Mm-hmm. And you have your favorites you like, but they're fun. And it kind of keeps your interest, kind of like the fantasy pools now in the different sports that people will play. So I kind of follow the teams that maybe I've had a chance to broadcast during the year just to see how far they can progress mm-hmm. or what kind of success they enjoy.
Mm-hmm. And this Kentucky team has recorded just an astonishing number of wins against top teams. They've lost a few maybe that people didn't expect them to lose. But things seem to be coming together, at least as far as how they are physically, and at least knowing what the situation is. How do you see Kentucky's chances as we talk on March 10th?
Well, I agree. I think it's been an outstanding season for them, considering, you know, only a couple walk-ons returning to the team. So to put together a whole new team, granted you have the transfer portal and the NIL money and everything, how the game has changed. But to accomplish 21 wins, I think, is where mm-hmm. we are going in the tournament. And they're very capable, you know, the style of play, they're basically trying to outscore their opponent. So if the shots are falling and they get hot for a stretch, they could make a run, and it should be an outstanding SEC tournament. There's a lot of good teams in this league, probably the toughest top to bottom that it's maybe ever been in the SEC. So you could lose first game or you could win a championship. And you could say that pretty much about any team in the conference if they get hot.
Yeah, the pathway through the teams that you might have to play would be actually a stiffer test, it seems, than at least on paper, than when you get into the NCAA, because there are so many top-flight teams in the SEC this year. Now, when you played, the tournament started up again. There had been an SEC tournament a long time ago, but started up again in 79. And it always has an opportunity for teams to step forward like your 79 team did and do better than expected, and we can see some possibility of some really great games.
It was a fun time, that 79 tournament. Nobody really kind of knew, because it had been 30-some years, I think, since they'd held the tournament. And for us, you know, we were coming off the national championship team. We'd lost four seniors, and we started pretty slowly that year. But we kind of found our identity midway through the season, got hot down the stretch. I think we maybe won 9 of 10 or 9 of 11 games, including then the tournament. But unfortunately, the way the tournament was set up, we had to win four games in four nights. And Tennessee was the one seed who we played in the final, and it was just their second game. I think we were up 7 or 8 at halftime. And up until that point, nothing had ever been said during the whole tournament about being tired. For some reason, when we came in at halftime with the lead, Coach Hall had us lay on our backs, put our feet up on the bench, kind of like we were astronauts getting ready to go up in the air. And I don't know. I've always wondered to this day if you know, maybe way in the back of our mind, that kind of planted that seed that fatigue might be a factor because we went to overtime, but then we just kind of ran out of gas, and I think they beat us by 5 or 6 mm-hmm. in the overtime.
Yeah, and that's a challenge that any set of players or any coach has to face as you as you participate in a tournament, because you are playing day after day. You don't want that to get into your head. At the same time, you got to get back out there and turn in another effort the next day against probably even a better team than you faced the day before. So tournament time offers all kinds of different challenges, and that's just one of them, right?
Yeah, very much so. The physical challenge, but also the mental challenge of knowing that you are playing a very good team. And I think you have to kind of approach it like maybe you're a banker. The fact that you put this deposit in the bank all year long, all your practices, all your summer workouts and everything, and it's time to collect interest on that money. Mm-hmm. And so you want to put it to use. And not just every play, but every possession is so important in tournament time, because you watch how many games come down to 1 or 2 points, a missed free throw late or something like that. And so you really have to stay focused, and it's a mental challenge.
Well, all these teams will be facing it coming up this week, and as fans, we can sit back and enjoy. It's such a great time of the year, isn't it?
It's a super time of year, and from a fan's perspective, I mean, I know that 79 tournament down in Birmingham, the Jefferson Civic Center, fans love that because they were there all week long. And like you said, it was kind of a surprise. We just kept winning. We had some injuries. The players were out of the lineup, but just got on a roll. So, you know, to be able to enjoy it and watch your team do well, it's fun from a fan perspective as well, not just the players.
I would say it's not an overstatement to say that you've been around basketball all your life, because your father was a basketball coach. You grew up mostly in Fort Wayne, right, and then moved right to Peru. But did you just take to the game right away? Was it something that you immediately enjoyed as far as you can remember?
As far as I know, yeah. when I was young, right, my dad was a coach. He was a PE teacher. And when we moved to Fort Wayne when I was 3, from a small town just outside where he was a high school coach, he took a NAIA college job. And so from age 3, 4, and 5, I had my own jersey and uniform to match the teams, and would do the kind of mascot, take them out for layups and halftime, stay out and shoot around, do some dribbling, whatever. And so, yeah, as long as I can remember, I've been around the game. Fortunately, he taught, you know, I have a brother and a sister at the time. He taught us all different sports because of being the PE teacher he was in high school. So I still, to this day, play a lot of tennis, mm-hmm. Played baseball through high school, American Legion. And just, you know, you learn so much from sports, how to compete, how to get along with others, how to take instruction when things aren't going well, how you handle that and try to get back on the right track. So, I've always been a fan of basketball. I don't think I looked at it like maybe players nowadays do, the fact that I played because I loved to play. It didn't matter if there was an NBA or not at some point. That wasn't my goal when I was playing. It was because I enjoyed it so much. And I was pretty good at it, I think. And so I just liked the competition and the challenge of getting out there on the court and playing together.
Who were your basketball idols when you were growing up?
Well, when I was growing up, you know, they only had maybe one NBA game on during the course of the week, like on a Sunday afternoon, there'd be a game. So you didn't have the media exposure as much. So for me, the players that I tried to idolize and emulate were my father's players at Indiana Tech in Fort Wayne. Mm-hmm. It's an AIA school, engineering school. So I'd go to practice after school, and some of the players were kind enough to stick around maybe afterwards, play me a game of horse, or, you know, do a drop step from the free throw line, something like that. And so I'd go out there and you know, try to do the drop step or all different things. And so those are the guys I'd keep score during their games. Those are the ones I looked up to. And I was fortunate. My father has passed, but we had a lot of pictures from the school. So my brother and I took him over to the university, when we were he still lives up in Indiana, when I was up there visiting. And got the idea, maybe try to get those guys together for a reunion. So the winter before last, we had a reunion of we call it the Macy Men, mm-hmm. anybody that played for my father. So to get together and see all those guys, we've all aged quite a bit, obviously, but it was a whole lot of fun to see them, you know, 40 years later, if not more.
Yeah, and you mentioned the things that you learn from sports. Another thing that is a benefit is that you have these relationships with your teammates. You go through these things together, and many times that can result in lifetime friendships.
It does. You know, our 78 team to this day, we still have reunions. We still keep in touch with each other and send emails every so often as well. So it's has a big impact on your life.
Before I ask you about your high school playing career, a word about small college coaches. These are the people that have to do the same things that the major college coaches, the big stars that we see on TV, have to do. You got to recruit, you got to plan practices, you got to scout, you got to do all those things, and with in most cases a lot less help. But the challenges are still there, aren't they? Do the principles apply there?
Oh, same thing, same job, but you're right, a lot less people helping. In fact, he was not only the basketball coach, depending what year it was, I think he and his one assistant would just kind of, I don't know, draw of a hat or just talk it over, and I'll do baseball this year, I'll do track, and you do soccer, and I'll do tennis next year, whatever. And so, yeah, he coached a lot of different sports, but you're right, not near the budget. But for me, as a young kid, you know, those were the times that I cherished, and the fact that I was with him pretty much all the recruiting trips, the scouting trips. And we talk basketball, going to the game, or after the game on the ride back home, we talk about, you know, the game itself and what maybe an adjustment here or there a coach could have made, or what defense they were playing, all those type of things. So, that's really where I learned the mindset or the philosophy of coaching, and kind of what to look for and what not to do, and different situations, how you would react and like. So when I got an opportunity to coach, a lot of people are like, well, you've never been a head coach. How do you get a head coaching job? To me, I wasn't that concerned about it because I'd been through it, even though I was a real young age as I was going through it. But so it was kind of a natural thing I wanted to just try.
Well, as things progressed for you and by your senior year in high school, everyone knows who you are and that you're a candidate for Mr. Basketball, a very strong candidate there in 74-75. And I often wonder when I watch a high school game that has a player like that in it, and not that they're great in number, but they face a different kind of pressure, in that usually when you go on the road, there are bigger crowds than the other team usually has, and they all know who you are, and they're all ready to stop you tonight so that they can beat Peru or whoever the team happens to be. How does a high school player handle that? I see some guys do that. Most of them seem to do it with a lot of maturity, but it's a little bit different responsibility than most high school players have.
You know, I think for me personally, it was just the competitiveness that I had in me. In that I had a real good junior year, averaged quite a few points. My father was a coach, so I got to shoot a lot. No. but my competitiveness said that I'm not going to let that dip my senior year, and because a lot of people will think, oh, he's not as good this year. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to show them that I was not only as good, but even better my senior year, just having another year experience under my belt. So I kind of took that on as a challenge and made sure I was ready for every game. And also, too, the competitiveness, when you get in a hostile environment, I think, for me, it always made me focus more and want to play better, because just to kind of show them that they really didn't bother me and I could kind of block it out, do my thing.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the recruiting had progressed, I guess, all the way through high school. Lots of letters in those days and contacts. Tell me about that process for you.
For me, it was a little different in the fact that, yes, I did get a lot of letters, but I made the decision early that I didn't want to even talk about college until after I was done playing, because I didn't want it to kind of get my mind off of the challenge, like I said, that to show that I hadn't gotten become a less player my senior year from my junior year. And the pressure really wasn't bothering me, but I wanted to stay focused on the playing. Mm-hmm. So I did get those letters, and having a father that was a coach made it a lot easier, because the coaches would talk to him, and him, like myself, being a basketball junkie, he'd talk to him all night long if they wanted to. So he really enjoyed that process. And then once the season was over, then I took a look and started kind of narrowing the list down of schools that I was interested, and then schools that I wanted to visit, and then schools that I wanted to would consider going to.
Now, when you say when the season was over, was that your senior season in high school? So you didn't make up your mind until high school ball was over then?
No, I was very late deciding, and that's one of the reasons, you know, as we progress forward, that I probably didn't come to Kentucky first. I went to Purdue. Mm-hmm. It was into May when I made the decision, or actually I still hadn't made the decision. Kentucky contacted me. They'd been recruiting me and done visits and everything, and they finally said, because I think they thought maybe they were going to miss out on a guard if they didn't sign one soon. They kind of gave me an ultimatum and said, you know, we want to sign you, but if you're not ready, then we're going to sign another guard. We've got to have one more guard. As it turned out, it was Truman Clater, who I ended up playing with for a couple of years. But at that time, I still wasn't ready. So I said, no, but I understand, you know, do what you got to do. Mm-hmm. And I probably felt some pressure to stay in state. Purdue was about an hour from Peru, so it was pretty close. I could get back and forth, you know, see my family, whatever I wanted to. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was, you know, nowadays kids commit in like 7th, 8th grade. It's
right?
Crazy.
Yeah, yeah, they want to, I guess there's a viewpoint, if you get the decision out of the way early, then you can focus. But in your case, you decided to focus after the high school career.
And now there's a lot of things that go on between sophomore year, junior year, coaching changes, all the different. So I was happy that I waited because it allowed me to focus in and playing.
So Kentucky and Purdue were your top two when it coming down to it?
And I visited those two, and I visited Cincinnati, who was the top five team at the time, with Gail Catlett was the coach.
Yeah.
And then I went to UCLA and made a visit, although I kind of knew in the back of my head I wasn't going to travel that far away to go play. John Wooden had retired in 75, and you know, I didn't want to get lost in a shuffle because there were some good guards. I played some All-Star games against a couple of the teams from California, so I knew those players as well, and a few had committed. So, it was basically Kentucky and Purdue.
Yeah, and then so you end up at Purdue for the first year, then you make the decision to transfer, and I've heard you tell the story that you got back with Coach Hall when the time came to talk about where you might go next, and Kentucky at the top of the list, and the meeting went a little bit, off course as far as what you might have expected. He was, he had his serious face on, didn't he?
Well, Coach Hall always had a serious face on for the most part, but until after he retired. But yeah, when I decided to transfer, first I had to make the decision, do I want to go to a junior college for a year and then transfer again, or go and sit a year, which, again, having played before I could walk, probably, you know, holding the ball, and they'd hold me by the diaper and I'd drop it in the basket. That was kind of a thump. I had to really think about that. Did I want to sit out a full year and not play basketball? Granted, I could practice, but it wasn't the same. So I called Coach Hall because, you know, I never really told him no, but I was just so late. And we set up a meeting, and so I came down to Lexington and met with Coach Hall. And so the roles had changed. The year before, you know, he'd been recruiting me, and I really wasn't giving coaches much indication, interest, not interest, whatever, just kind of, you know, stone face. And so now I'm recruiting myself to Kentucky, and Coach Hall's given me the stone face until like the last 5 minutes, and then he finally said, well, I guess we can give it a try. So,
you know, looking back on that era, and I was working in media at that time, and of course we saw him a lot less than you did, but he never seemed very happy to see any of us either. So that was his image changed. I mean, he had the sense of humor, and occasionally you might hear it in a public talk that he was giving when he was coaching or something, but boy, when he stepped on the court, I mean, it was serious business, wasn't it?
It was, and you're right. You didn't really know that he had that sense of humor until after he retired as a player, and then your relationship kind of changed when you graduated and he got away from coaching, or even when he was still coaching and you graduated, get him off the court, and he was, because he was so intense on, you know, wanting to uphold the Kentucky image and the success of Adolph Rupp and the pressure he felt, I'm sure, of following Coach Rupp. So, yeah, it was two different people, seemed like.
Yeah. Now, after the transfer year, you make it through that. How did you make it through that? You said you had your doubts about how that would be for you. How was it?
It was tough, yeah. Fortunately, like I said, I got to practice. So Larry Johnson was a senior guard on that team and an outstanding player, really strong, quick, fast. So I got to go against him every day in practice. And that, along with the year of maturity, being in the weight room probably when I was – a freshman, I may have weighed 160 pounds soaking wet, so I'd never been in a weight room. So I remember the first time I walked in the old Seton Center where the weight room used to be and opened the door, and there's Art Still, you know, All-American football player and played in a professional league for a long time. And, you know, he's chiseled, like his shoulders are 36 inches wide and his waist was 24 and, you know, he's just all muscle. And I think he's cleaning like 45 pounds on each side, five of those per side. And I'm walking in there the first time, like I said, about 160 soaking wet and thinking,
I must have walked into the wrong room.
Yeah. But, you know, it helped me because I ended up playing my playing weight. It was probably about 186, so mm-hmm. I gained some weight and strength. And just having that year to learn the offense, not being just thrown in the fire, got to know the players, their tendencies, what they like to do. And from a point guard position, that's important to kind of get a feel for their personality as well. And we had a good practice squad as well. And Jim Andrews, who played here, was one of the grad assistants. Mm-hmm. Trip Ramsey was a manager. So once in a while, we'd be on the scout squad. And, you know, we had a pretty good scrub team or whatever you want to call it.
Pretty competitive.
Yeah.
So after that year, which ended in a loss to North Carolina in the regionals, and that Kentucky team really was capable of going all the way, I think, had they gotten by there. But now you're left. A lot of the guys are key players are coming back as seniors the next year, and it just shapes up from the very beginning that Kentucky is going to be the team that everybody is shooting at. It was your championship to win, and you've heard the phrase a season without celebration for the last 47 years, but the pressure was on Coach Hall, but you all as players. It was a little different for you. I mean, you were in different roles. I'm sure you felt some of the expectations, but on the other hand, it didn't just consume your lives, did it?
I don't think it consumed our lives, but we were aware of the expectations. And most of the season, we were ranked number one. But I think that's where the experience for the seniors really came in as far as making sure we were ready because, you know, as freshmen, they'd got to the final game. John Wooden's last game, UCLA out in San Diego, they lost, but they, you know, and I think when we got to St. Louis to make that quick jump, the approach was much different. It wasn't like we were just happy to be there and you know, they went to the San Diego Zoo or they went to the beach, whatever. When mm-hmm. we were in St. Louis, we were there to win a championship. We weren't there to, you know, see the arch or whatever. Mm-hmm. So from day one of our preseason conditioning, each day through the end of the season, we were aware of what our goal was. It wasn't just to have a good practice or, you know, to play well, which is what you want to do. But we also were thinking long term, and the ultimate goal was to win a championship because they'd got to the finals. They'd won the NIT as sophomores, and then like you mentioned, they got beat in the regional their junior year. So this was their last chance to win a championship. And so we stayed very focused.
One thing about that season, as an aside, you've always been a great fan favorite, and of course, this was the days long before social media or even cell phones. But tell me about your interactions with fans. Some of I'm sure you received a lot of correspondence, and fans would come up to you when you had an opportunity to meet with them in public. Tell me about some of those encounters.
Well, Kentucky fans are the best. I mean, they'll support you thick and thin, no matter where you go. I mean, after I played here, playing professional, whether it was in Seattle or overseas even, it seems like there's always a Kentucky fan in the crowd that will come up before or after the game, say, hey, I saw the Kansas game, whatever, and tell details about each game. So, excuse me, we used to play Notre Dame New Year's Eve in Freedom Hall, and we'd have an open practice the morning of the game. Coach Hall would open up, quick shoot around, whatever. And then they'd set up tables and we'd sign autographs. And I remember my sophomore year, our championship season, the table in front of Rick Roby, the crowd was surrounding him so much that the table collapsed. I think there was a young lady, or even may have been an older lady, that kind of snuck up behind him and was trying to clip a piece of his hair while he was sitting there at the table before it collapsed. So, I mean, they're passionate about their basketball.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, that year did result in a championship, and you had some challenges in the tournament. And I've heard you mention that the Arkansas game was maybe the toughest one. The game against Duke in the championship, the score is deceptively close at the end, but Kentucky was in charge for much of that game. But in Arkansas, that one went right down to the wire.
It did. They had the triplets, which was Moncrief, Brewer, and Delph. Played kind of a perimeter offense with Eddie Sutton as a coach, who's an outstanding defensive coach. If you look at our tournament, each game along the way, there was someone different that was kind of the star of that game. Mm-hmm. And I think that is perfect for describing that team. We didn't really rely on one player every night. we kind of could make adjustments. And if it took this to win the game, then we'd go that way. If it took that, we'd do that. Defensively, we could do full court. We could do half. Man, we played the 1-3-1 zone. The coach Rupp taught Coach Hall. And so we were a very versatile squad. We were big and strong and physical, but we also had real good perimeter players with Truman, Jay Scheidler coming in off the bench, James Lee coming in off the bench, myself. We could shoot the ball pretty well, and so we were very versatile and could adapt to different systems. First game, we got behind Florida State. Coach Hall makes a gutsy move and starts the second half with three bench players, reserves. Didn't play the whole half, but they kind of shocked the starters that he took out and kind of had the effect he was looking for. Doesn't go right, he maybe loses his job.
Yeah, let me stop you right there just for a minute, because I happen to be at that game, and here's the box score from that game. And if you look at the Kentucky players, the minutes played down there at the bottom, and of course it also tells us how long ago it was, and that they entered the numbers by hand to run off the copier machine, but to distribute to media. But I think LaVon Williams played 14 minutes, and Fred Cowan played 14 minutes. Dwayne Casey was six. Those were the three guys that came in there at the half. And you say it was a gutsy move. And most people think that had that gone wrong and had Kentucky lost that game going out in the first round after being favored all year long, that it could have been the end of the line for Coach Hall.
Yeah, and there seems like every tournament champion that there's a game where you have to have a little luck or be a little bit fortunate. And, we weren't playing very well. I don't know if the pressure, maybe the seniors were kind of feeling a little bit. So that shock treatment, I think, kind of got their focus back in. And as well as the rest of the team, from then on, we were really focused on the task at hand. Mm-hmm. Next game, we play Miami of Ohio, and Mike Phillips, who was from Ohio, had a big game. Truman, also from Ohio, had a good game, I think, as well. Then that took us to Michigan State. Yeah. I was fortunate to draw some fouls and made some free throws late. The next game, Arkansas, was just a battle because they were so good defensively and offensively, presented some problems with their perimeter play. Roby was consistently strong, I think, in that game. And then the finals, Jack had one of those nights where he just couldn't miss. Yeah. I think he scored 19 straight points towards the end of the first half and to start the second half. And one, he banked from deep in the right-hand corner, kind of slithered off the side of the backboard and slid in.
Right.
Wasn't really a bank shot, kind of a slide shot, if you will. And we kind of knew then that he had the hot hand. So we kind of changed our offense. And Duke, for whatever reason, in their 2-3 zone they were playing, they never really adjusted. And so we just kept finding Jack in the gaps. And he'd either make the shot, or if he missed, he was quick enough to go by Gaminski in the middle if he came into the middle of the lane and get the rebound and put it back in. So, but again, that just kind of exemplifies the team that year, how we were so versatile and didn't really rely on one thing to happen, but we had different options.
And a national championship is forever. I mean, that's something where the fans, whether they're old enough to actually remember it or not, or whether they just read about it, it's something that establishes your names, you and your teammates, forever in the minds of Kentucky fans. And I guess at the time you're just thinking about win the game and celebrate, and then it takes some time, doesn't it, to reflect and see just actually how meaningful it is?
Yeah, I think still to this day, you kind of reckon. I mean, because there's so many people that I've met or have come up to me and said, it's like my name has changed from just Kyle Macy to, oh, you're Kyle Macy from the national championship team. So the title expands a little bit. But, I mean, it's great to – and they all, do you ever get tired of talking about that? And the answer is no, because it was a great time in your life and a great time in your playing career. So it's a lot of people. My dad or my grandfather, I spent time with him sitting and listening to Kaywood on the radio to your games, because a lot of our games were, they were delayed telecast back then. So
yeah,
I know I don't look as old as.
Yeah, of course not. No, we haven't aged a bit. It was quite the celebration of the national championship team. It may have been termed a season without celebration, but it was a huge celebration once you actually won and came back to Lexington.
Yeah, and to this day it still is. I mean, the team, like I said, we have reunions, and it's a whole lot of fun. But it just, I think the media was looking for a story. Duke was a young team and just kind of happy to be there, like the Kentucky team of 75 maybe. And we were an experienced team, a lot more focused. But, we just, you know, did what we had to do to win. But coming back, I always wondered, Coach Hall, for some reason, really wanted to get back to Lexington that night. And there was a plane part or something that was missing, or there was bad weather. They were waiting on to DIs. I don't even remember. But I know we were on the plane for a long time instead of just getting off, getting a hotel, and then go back, have a parade or whatever the next day. He wanted to get back that night. So I don't think we got back to the airport till like 2 in the morning.
It was, middle of the night. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it didn't seem to bother the crowd.
No, they were just getting started.
Yeah, because Bluegrass Field, it was packed shoulder to shoulder. And at that time, I don't think they still have them, but when you came in, you walked downstairs right up against the wall, and then the lobby was to the left. Well, for some reason, they had each player one at a time go down those stairs and then into a room just off the end of the stairs. And so as a player would walk down those stairs, the crowd would just push and move, you know, right up. And you were kind of pinned against the wall between the end of the stairs and getting to that door. And then you'd finally make it in there, and the crowd would kind of slide back. And it was just like a wave up. Here comes a player, wave back, wave back. And so, and then, you know, cars were everywhere. I think the X-ray machines were torn up. They cost the airport quite a bit of money, I think, replacing those. And cars even parked all along Versailles Road. So it was crazy.
It really was quite the spectacle. I was at the airport that night. I had the assignment of covering the return of the team. And so you could look out and just see the thousands of cars or of people and what seemed like thousands of cars just parked anywhere you could find a space. But quite a tribute. And those have followed in the years since. They still have the big celebrations after a championship, but they've steered those away from the airport now. So that get them back at Rupp where we can handle a crowd. That sets you on the road to the professional ranks. And tell me about your draft status, because you had been drafted the year before, is that right? How did that work?
Yeah, at that time, you didn't have to declare to go into the draft. They had what they called hardship. You could say, you know, I'm going to leave early because of hardship. But also, if you had 5 years to play four, but after your fourth year, after your class graduated, you were eligible for the draft. Well, I had been in school for 4 years, but I had to sit out that year. So I still had 1 year of eligibility. That was going to be my fifth year, one at Purdue, and this would have been my senior year at Kentucky. Excuse me. So I didn't declare for the draft. I think I talked to Portland after my junior year, which I'd played in the Pan American Games and had some, you know, success. I wasn't really expecting anyone to draft me. Because Stu Inman, who is the general manager of Portland, came to Lexington. We just had a little meeting there, and I basically told him I'm coming back to school. And so I was getting ready for the Pan American Games at the time of the draft. So I was out in Colorado Springs where they pass out all the gear, your jackets you wear for the parade and your uniform, everything. We were all staying in the dorm there at the Air Force Academy. And someone yelled down the hall, "You got a phone call." So it was a pay phone down at the end of the hall. So I walked down there and pick up the phone. Hello. And they said, "Hey, this is so-and-so from the Lexington Herald Leader. How do you feel about being drafted by the Phoenix Suns?"
Wow.
Like, what are you talking about? You know, it wasn't like they flew me to New York and we had a big TV show and all that. So it was a little bit different back then. But, I was excited because I liked Phoenix and I thought it'd be a good fit eventually, but they knew I wanted to play my senior year, and so they were fine with it. They drafted me knowing that I was going to go back, but the problem for me was that it put me in a dilemma a little bit in the fact that when I was done playing in college, that was an Olympic year, 1980. And so if I had played on the Olympic team, which I'd played on the Pan Am team, you know, after that, we won the gold medal, and most of those players would have had their foot in the door to be on the Olympic team. But if I'd played in the Olympic team, that would have been after the next draft. So my rights would have gone back in the draft. Anybody else could have taken me. I could have ended up at the time, like, New Jersey was terrible, and it wouldn't have been a good fit for me. So I was going to have to make a tough decision. And so after the season was over, as it turned out, that was the year Jimmy Carter boycotted the Olympics. So I didn't sign. I didn't even try out for the Olympics as much as I wanted to and would have loved to have played for our country. I went ahead and signed my contract with Phoenix.
And you mentioned the Pan Am Games. That was an eventful time for you as well, and maybe not a pleasant memory, but one that stands out with your let's call it an injury, but and then your relationship with Bob Knight during that time too.
Yeah, a lot of memories from the Pan Am Games. Yeah, I spent a month in Bloomington practicing with the team, and you know I wasn't really recruited that hard by Coach Knight. He came up to Prue one time when I was in high school, and which was nice of him. When I was down there practicing, he came up one day after practice and said, you know, if I had to do it again, I'd recruit you a little harder. I don't know if that would have changed me going to IU, because they still had Buckner, Wilkerson, Wisman, Cruz, and they signed Bob Bender the first year. But that was nice of him to take time and say that. But I spent a month there. We took a trip as a team to Italy for, I don't know, 7-10 days. We then went to Puerto Rico and were playing very well. I enjoyed the experience, you know, playing a lot of great players in that team. Unfortunately, for me, mm-hmm. you know, we had beat Cuba by 40 in the qualifying rounds, and we were playing them again. I think it was the quarterfinals, and we were up 20, getting ready to go to 40 by the end of the game. And it was like they'd called it at halftime to take one of our players out, and I must have got the short straw, because I was playing good, well, but I wasn't, you know, the star of the team, scoring the most points. So start second half, I passed to my left and turned to my right and got hit in my jaw on my right side, broke my mandible on my left side. So I had to they didn't have the right x-ray machine there at the Village, so I had to spend the night in the Village with the broken jaw, just aspirin, till the next morning they could get me to a dental surgeon, whatever, there in town, and did the panoramic view, saw it was broken, immediately got me on a plane, got back to Lexington. It's the fastest I've ever been through Atlanta Airport. Came back, and it just so happened the gate where I got off and the gate I was getting onto Lexington was right next door. And the guy
that never happens.
No. And the guy that was manning the tickets was a basketball fan, recognized me. My family was with me. And we got on an earlier flight. Would have had to wait a few hours before our actual connection. So he got me on that plane. I was probably through Atlanta like 15 minutes, which is unheard of. And then Dr. Lynn Morrow wired my jaw shut for 7 weeks. Wow. Going into my senior year.
Yeah, yeah. And so that certainly changed the summer. So it's the summer for you.
Yeah.
There. That was
a lot
quite
of milkshakes.
Instant. Yeah, a lot of people reading about that and concerned about that as you headed into the next season. But so we talked about eventually connecting with Phoenix. So you start NBA life, and in addition to just the challenge of being an NBA basketball player, there is the challenge of NBA life, too. It's sort of a double challenge for the young player, isn't it?
It is. Number one, you have to pinch yourself a few times when you first start playing, because you're now – I'm lined up for a free throw next to Dr. J, mm-hmm. You know, and all these guys you've heard about and watched some on TV. And you're actually out there blocking him out or doing those type of things. So you just have to remind yourself to play. Don't watch. Play.
Right.
And then once you get used to that, I think that one of the toughest things, well, anytime you change levels, grade school, middle school, high school, blah, 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 you have to make that adjustment to the speed of the game. But once you make that adjustment, I think one of the things that all rookies should be aware of and need to learn as soon as they do, they're much better, is that it's a really long season and you've got to get your rest whenever you can. It may be, you know, sleeping on the plane to the next city, mm-hmm. whatever. Although nowadays the players are kind of pampered with their charter planes and all that stuff. We had the rule, it was all commercial travel. And the rule was if you played, say, a Friday night in Phoenix and you were playing in Seattle on Saturday, you had to take the first flight out. Well, if a game doesn't get over till 10 o'clock, 10:30, whatever, by the time you get out of there at the earliest, then you got to wind down, then you got to find something to eat, and then you got to be at the airport by 5:30 or so for a 6 or maybe 5 even for a 6 o'clock flight. And then to fly from Phoenix to Seattle is a lot different than going from Boston to New Jersey or New York. So you just have to understand the demands of travel, because it seems like every rookie their first year, they get to a point where they kind of hit that wall for a while and then they kind of get it. So they start taking a little bit better care of their body and getting the rest when they need it.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think fans don't think about that. Of course, the charter flights have made such a difference when you can just walk on the plane and take off, and then you're on your way. But even that, travel is always somewhat challenging. But in the days of having to take a commercial flight, wow, that just adds a whole new element to it. You had a very solid stay in Phoenix. What do you recall about your time in Phoenix? What stands out about that, what is it, five-year period?
Yeah, I loved that period of time. It was a real good team, great group of guys. In fact, they invited all former players back for their home opener this year, and I had a chance to go out and see the game, and got together with six or seven of the guys I played with and called them that were coming back. And so we got together the night before and sat around and told stories and had a great time. So, again, you talk about the relationships of players you play with. And so we were a very competitive team. We won the division my first year. But it seemed like in the playoffs we could never get past the Lakers, which were the Showtime Lakers, Magic and Kareem and Worthy and all those guys. So, but we had, Walter Davis was an all-star, Alvin Adams was an all-star, Chuck Robinson. There was a trade made. Dennis Johnson was brought in from Seattle before he was traded then to Boston when we brought Rick Roby to Phoenix. So, it was a great time. I mean, the weather was perfect. I'd come back to Kentucky in the summer, get out of the super hot weather, have basketball camps back here, and so it was kind of the best of both worlds.
Well, after the 5 years in Phoenix, then you move on to Chicago, and you're in the backcourt as a starter for that period of time with Michael Jordan. And this was the pre-Bulls championship era, but you were a running mate of his, and he was in the first, two or three years of his career.
It was second year.
Second year. Okay, yeah. Tell me about that whole relationship there.
Well, I would have liked to have stayed in Phoenix. But they decided they were going to go to a different style of play with maybe a faster pace. Now I can run, but I'm not super fast. So they brought in some younger guards, and they started the season 0-11 and went back to the old style. But I was in Chicago by then, so kind of disappointed. They paid for a foreign player. They paid his interpreter as much as I would have taken maybe just to renew my contract.
Yeah.
But – that's water under the bridge. But so I'm in Chicago. Yeah, unfortunately, that was Michael's second year, which was the year he hurt his ankle and only played 15 regular season games. My job would have been to come in and spot up when they double-teamed Michael and get a lot of wide-open jump shots, which I thought would be a pretty good job description. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, he didn't play but 15 games, got back in time for the playoffs, and we played the Celtics in the first round. In fact, I tell the story that we played the Celtics. The first game was a double overtime in the old Boston Garden, and we lost in double overtime. But Michael and I combined for 70 points.
Is that right?
Yeah. He had 63, and I had 7.
Well, that was a great productivity from the backcourt that
night.
It was it instantly. I mean, you I'm sure had known him and knew about him and knew about his personality and all. But when you see that competitiveness up close, was it really outstanding at that time in his career? Was he still maturing at that point?
A little bit of both. I mean, he was competitive. He's always been competitive, but I think he was still maturing. And they didn't get the championships till probably 8 or 9 years even after that. So it took him a while. I know there were times he wanted to kind of do maybe too much. The games he was able to play. In fact, that game, if you go back and look, there was times in that second overtime where he had been on a roll, but there were guys that were wide open. Maybe if he'd given it up once or twice, we might have won that game instead of trying to do it all himself. Yeah. And I think, I've read some things that have been written where Phil Jackson kind of taught him you have to trust your teammates. And but you could tell he was competitive. He was going to be an outstanding player.
Well, you had 7 years in the NBA, and then you move on to Italy. Tell me about the deciding to make a move like that, and then a little bit about the experience in Italy.
Well, I went from Chicago a year. They had John Paxson came in, who was a little younger than myself, and so they went with him. I went to Indiana, and that year was really probably the most disappointing of any of my basketball career seasons, in the fact that I never really got a chance to play. They had Vern Fleming from Georgia, SEC player at one guard spot, and John Long had been with Detroit for quite a few years at the other guard spot. Vern's not known for his outside shooting. He's more of a kind of a forward in a guard's body in around the basket. And John Long was not shooting very well at all. He was like 30-some percent. And Clint Richardson, who was sitting next to me on the bench, had been with the Sixers, and they'd won the world championship. So he had great experience. And we never really got much playing time. There was one time one of the assistant coaches said, get ready, we're going to get you guys in a game. We that game actually did play over 15 minutes. And we both played solid and thought, well, okay, we'll get more minutes now. Very next game went right back to it. So I think from an outsider's view, if you looked at that season, is well, if he's in Indiana, we made the playoffs, but we weren't a very good team. And they're thinking, well, if he can't play with that team, you know, who's he going to play with? And so there wasn't much interest the following year. So that's when I decided, well, I still wanted to play and felt like I could play. So I went over to Italy and played for three seasons, which was a great experience. They love their basketball over there. The arenas aren't as big, but they're into it. And I was fortunate. Bologna was always a Virtus team there. It was always a team competing for championships. And then to Treviso, which is at the time the sponsor was Benetton Clothing. And that was a great experience as well. So actually, I would have gone back more, but there was an agent that kind of was pulling stuff. And so whatever, it didn't work out. Mm-hmm. But 10 years for slow, short guys, not too bad.
10 years is I did minor league baseball for a long time, and it gets you to appreciate that making the big leagues and staying there, that's a great career in itself, you know. And you had some solid numbers. You averaged nearly in double figures and contributed a lot to your teams. But yeah, just establishing yourself and being on a roster and having a position, that's quite the climb right there.
Yeah, and you know, there were some years I did average double figures, but and I led the league 2 years in free throw shooting percentage in the NBA. And so it took me a little while to adjust that it was – the pro game is more of a business than a game, whereas college, it's a game. And so I'm – here I am, this little kid from, you know, Indiana, mm-hmm. playing professional basketball. I'm still thinking it's a game. We got to win. We do whatever you can to win the game. As opposed to, well, we may play this guy more minutes because we want to get him some exposure so we can trade him.
Right.
The business aspect of it. So yeah.
Yeah, and you find that the high draft picks, the people that have been invested in, those are the guys who are going to play too, right. Aren't they? The money determines the decision.
Or even worse, if you're defending Magic Johnson and you're not within 2 feet of him and he goes down the lane and yells, that the official blows a whistle and gives him a call. So
different set of rules, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me come back to the Italian experience. You talk about the things that you can learn from sports, and if you can go high enough, you can get some great opportunities. And of course, some college teams have the chance to tour internationally too. But the international exposure, especially for a lot of players who wouldn't otherwise have that, that's got to be, if you've got your eyes and ears open, you can really learn a lot and make it a great experience, can't you?
Yes, you very much can. The problem, I think, with some of the American players that go over there, they either, one, think that they've got to get back because they want to be in the NBA, so they don't really appreciate the experience and the opportunity, or two, they think it's the American game, which it's not. It's the Italian game and the international rules and all that stuff. But you also, if you understand going into the adjustment, that if the team wins, it's because the Italians played well. And if the team loses, it's because the American didn't do enough. Yeah. Okay. So if you understand that, then yeah, it's a great experience. I loved it. I would have played more if I could have.
Mm-hmm. And then the chance to be in another culture, another country. And
travel, you know, mm-hmm. off days. I think it was one of my second year over there. Rob Locke, former Kentuckian, was playing over there as well at a different team. And we'd get together maybe on the weekends off. You'd played Sunday afternoon. And so you'd have Monday, Tuesday. Sometimes some teams take even Wednesday off. Mm-hmm. We'd go meet together somewhere and go to Austria, Germany, or travel around Europe. So.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about the coaching phase of your career as you, of course, grew up with your dad as a coach. You'd been around basketball and coaching all your life. You had mentioned earlier that even though you had not had a head coaching job before, you didn't think about that as being a real obstacle since you had the experience that you had. But you, I would assume, took from various coaches that you played for in addition to your dad as far as how you – there he is. Yeah. And that's you right there next to him, right?
Yeah.
I was looking at the picture of Bob Macy and Kyle from back in the day in Indiana, but that was the start for you. But you developed his influence, I'm sure, and then the others to form your own coaching style.
Yeah, I think every coach does. If you're playing for a coach, you remember what you liked that he did. You definitely remember what you didn't like that he did, and then you pick and choose from the different. And I was fortunate. I played for a lot of really good coaches. Obviously, my father taught me how to play and the fundamentals and the basics from there. Coach Hall, I think, taught me probably more the discipline of the game, of making sure you're prepared and being ready for each game, and the discipline it takes to be at your best, how hard you have to work. And then John McLeod at Phoenix, I think, probably taught me more about how to be a professional player. Even as far as tipping in restaurants, he'd always talk to the team about, you know, you're making really good money. You don't need to be cheap with your tip and those type of things. And so Jack Ramsey was a Pacers coach. Stan Albeck was a good basketball mind in Chicago. So I was fortunate. I played for a lot of really good players. Even in Italy, my first year in Bologna, Krizmir Kosic, who was played at BYU, was Croatian, was the head coach. And he was kind of ahead of his time, not only as a player, because he was 6'9", and I think played point guard, but he kind of installed a perimeter offense because they had an Italian player at a guard spot that was on the national team, an outstanding player as well that I still kind of keep in touch with. And so he kind of built the offense around us, and it was working. I mean, we were really playing well. Unfortunately, Roberto sprained his ankle right before the playoffs started, so we didn't get to see that into fruition through the playoffs. But, you know, a lot of people are looking at him like, you're not running plays at the post, which nowadays everybody runs plays at the guards, I guess.
That's right, that whole five-out kind of offense, the game at which I wanted to ask you about the changes in the game, and that would certainly be one of them, the traditional big man that was such a valuable part of teams for so many years. I mean, that position almost doesn't exist, at least in the preference of most coaches.
Yeah, no, not with the way the game is. And that's funny. I always ask myself, okay, so Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Hakeem Olajuwon, Patrick Ewing, Artis Gilmore. Mm-hmm. These are all guys that I was fortunate were in the league when I was in the league. Could they play in today's college game the way it's opened up the floor and they're shooting threes? Obviously you'd have to make some adjustments because they are so dominant low post, but it's really the post game is really stretched out.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, too, about the idea of sitting in the chair that I'm in now. You're the interviewer in one project that you had going on recently, that from the rafters of RUP, in which you talked to a lot of not just your former teammates, but UK players from every era. How did that come about? And tell me about your enjoyment of that project.
Well, I'll answer in reverse. It was great enjoyment. Was just a whole lot of fun sitting there and listening to the players that lived the experience tell about the experience. Because, you know, as a former player, you kind of have a bond. And so you've heard stories about what certain players did or certain games they performed in. And to be able to ask them to tell me about it and hear it firsthand was just a blast. But how it came about, I'd been doing SEC games before the SEC network started for about 4 or 5 years. So, and it was a real nice gig. I'd fly to Charlotte where the headquarters were and do the studio all day on a Saturday. There was a late night flight back to Lexington that I could catch after the studio work. I'd be in my own bed Saturday night. And then I'd go to a game somewhere within the SEC on a Wednesday. And that was basketball season, which was great because I'm, you know, front row of all these great teams in the SEC, all the different cities, and which I was very familiar with. So I thought, dummy me, I thought when they went to an SEC network that I'd kind of have my foot in the door, get an opportunity to be on that. Mm-hmm. And I'd heard the story that each school was asked to submit 4 or 5 names from their school, former players that they would recommend for the broadcast. And having been at Kentucky for 4 years with the broadcast radio crew before I took the head coaching job at Moorhead, you know, it wasn't like I'd never done a game before. I had pretty good experience. Well, I didn't. If I was on the list, I wasn't very high up on the list because I never got a call even to talk about it, let alone be hired. So I still wanted to, you know, continue to improve my interviewing skills and my broadcasting. I enjoyed that. So I came up with the idea that I knew how passionate Kentucky fans were about their team and their players, just to interview players that had their jerseys retired in the rafters of RUP. And that's how I came up with the idea. It took about a year to get it on the air. I went to all the different stations, presented the idea. They all loved it, but financially they weren't willing to back it. And I just believed in the project and said, okay, I'll do it myself. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of stubborn, hard-headed like that. If you tell me no, it usually motivates me to show you you're wrong. So I went out, sold all the sponsorships, got all the stations on board. We went from five stations in-state to a station in Evansville, a station in Huntington, West Virginia. So we covered basically the state. The thing that bothered me is I look back, 8 years later, the stations really never promoted the show and told when it was going to be on. And so it was kind of hit or miss. If you're a viewer out in Bowling Green or Paducah, you just had to be flipping through channels pretty much because they never advertised, be sure to catch Rafters of RUP at 9 o'clock Thursday night or whatever, before the Kentucky. And so we did 8 years. We did five shows a season, one per month of basketball season. And each show was about one. We started, the first show was about two people, but we realized that was too quick. So we did one player per show. And after the 5 years, that was everyone except for Rick Pitino, who we couldn't get, Jamal Mashburn, who we never could work out the getting everything hooked up in time. He was down in Florida. And then we contacted Pat Riley. He's the only one that turned us down. And he was, the quote was, he, according to his assistant, that he was trying to limit his media exposure at that time. So other than that, we interviewed everybody that was living that still had their jerseys hanging in RUP. And then the last 3 years, because it was so well-received, the people that did see it, we did five more shows each season of players that may be there at some point or real popular when they played and kind of catch up with where they were now and those type of things. So,
yeah, and I would think that you discover, as we're doing a podcast here for WUKY, the chance to get to talk to somebody for longer than 5 minutes or a short news interview or something like that. It's really a lot of fun, and you learn a lot about people.
Yeah, very much so. Now, I did do a lot of background studying to get ready for the interviews, and it's funny because most everyone would ask me, well, how long will this take to do this interview? I said, as long as you want to go. You know, you talk as much as you want. Well, it's always their favorite subject themselves, so most of them go close to 2 hours. So the hard part then was trying to edit it down to a 30-minute show, which is basically 23 minutes of content. And then we, you know, trying to get pictures and things to tie in what they're talking about and the B-roll, if you will. But it was a great project. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. How's your relationship with UK these days? I mean, you're such a revered former player, and everything good as far as connecting back with the university?
Personally, from my side, I've never – there seems to be kind of an image that I don't like UK, which makes no sense at all. I love UK. And I know there was a thing a few years back where I was on a radio station in Indianapolis, and – I made the comment about I don't feel, what was it I said? I didn't say I didn't feel welcome or whatever it was. I didn't say it the right way. What I meant to say was I maybe didn't feel as comfortable going back. They'd asked me about going back to Coach Cal's practices. And what I meant was that, well, Bill Keitley had passed, and he was really the last connection that I had with the staff or players. You know, you could always go when Bill was still around and talk to him first, and he'd kind of give you a feel of the temperature there and, you know, what was going on, the coaches or the certain players. And so it really kind of tied you in. But when he passed, unfortunately, you kind of felt like you lost that connection. I didn't know Cal well enough. I know he used my name at the press conference, first thing, but I didn't know him really well enough to where I felt comfortable just to walk into practice, say, hey, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. With Bill, you felt like you could walk in the equipment room any time, day or night, and he'd have time to talk to you or whatever. So that was misunderstood. But also I had a little run-in when I was doing some broadcast with the athletic director. He came up and accused me of – I gave a ticket to a friend of mine's son who was in school at UK at the time. And he acted like I was, and I guess what happened, I didn't know until after it was later explained to, that the son and the daughter, who was also in school, who babysit for my kids at the time, she didn't go to the game, so her brother took the ticket and gave it to another guy. Well, I was asked about this guy. I said, I don't know who that is. And they said, well, he's on the golf team, and that's a violation that you're giving tickets out, which, you know, that's a stretch in the fact that the guy I went to school with, I gave his son and daughter tickets for the game. But I was accused like I was trying to commit a, you know, crime. And I didn't really say anything because I had to go do the second half on the air. But the more I thought about it, it kind of upset me how it was handled. And so I wrote a letter and just expressed, you know, and it was early. I think he'd just gotten here. I didn't appreciate how it was handled. But I, you know, I was very supportive and would be. So since then it's, but there, for some reason, there's an image out there that I don't know why.
But everything's good as far as you're concerned.
Yeah, for me, the game's changed. It's sometimes hard to watch, but
yeah.
But I'm still, if Kentucky's playing, I hope they win.
you're still right there. Well, UK fans are glad to know that, I'm sure. I want to ask you about your current activity. In fact, you'll be leaving here and heading for tennis practice. You're coaching tennis. Tell me about that.
Yeah, this is, I went back and counted. I think it's my 18th season of coaching high school tennis, Lexington Christian Academy. When we moved back from Moorhead, my daughter, my oldest, was going to go to LCA, and I was just looking on the website and said they had an opening for a tennis coach, and I wasn't doing anything. I wasn't coaching, and so I knew the AD, went over and talked to him, and Brenda Emery was coaching the girls' team at the time. A few years later, she retired, so I've been coaching both boys and girls. And like I said, I think this is the start of my 18th year.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you're doing well with that and enjoying it enough that you'd like to continue for a while, huh?
Well, I'm definitely not in it for the money.
Yeah.
But, you know, any teacher is not in it for the money.
Right.
But, I enjoy it, and I enjoy playing, too. I play some age tournaments and those type of things, and USTA League when I have time in the schedule. It keeps those competitive juices flowing, and it's a lot of fun. A lot of similarities with basketball. And your eye-hand coordination, your footwork, your jump stop, split step, those type of things. So, yeah, it's great. And then still doing some broadcasting games. You know, just got back from a conference tournament final last night. So whatever I can pick up. Uh-huh. Anybody listening, once I'm good for hire.
Broadcaster available. Yeah, and so you keep the connection with basketball that way, and I would guess as long as you're able to do that, you will probably continue to do things that will keep you connected with the game, won't you?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been around the game. People ask me, well, would you ever want to coach again? And the answer is yes, I would at the right spot. And I say that in the fact that, you know, I took the Moorhead job because I always had that itch. I wanted to be a head coach. I wanted to try coaching. You know, I'd been around it my whole life, watched my father coach. And it was a great experience for me. Unfortunately, we didn't have the resources that, you know, a lot of our competition did. And on one end, we were kind of used to just to financially supply money for the entire athletic program. And so if you look at my record, you know, proud of the fact that we did win the regular season in the OVC 1 year. And if you look at my record, it doesn't look very good, so it'd be hard to get hired. But when you understand that we played basically five games a year, guarantee money to bring in for the program, and flip those five, play teams that we knew we were going to beat, then it's a pretty good record.
Mm-hmm.
So I am proud of that and the impact I've had on the players' lives. Whether it's the old man assistant on the bench at the right spot or whatever, I still – like the game, even though the game has changed considerably. But yeah. So.
Well, we wish you well with whatever you do, and you're always going to mean a lot to UK fans, you and your teammates in 78, a national championship, truly an experience that will stay with the fans who are old enough to remember it and be meaningful to those who aren't as they look back on it, too. I appreciate you taking the time to do this today.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate you having me. And like I've said years and years that with that transfer down here to Kentucky, I couldn't have sat down and written a better script the way things turned out. Very fortunate.
You've been listening to the WUKY Sports Page with your host, Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced at the WUKY studios by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through iTunes, Google Play, or at our website, wuky.org.